Hello, this is Eaten by a Gru, the Infocom podcast.
Wait, we're at Kansas Fest. Didn't we just do one of these?
Yeah, it was like 2 days ago, and here we are again. And we're going to spoil our listeners and go, oh boy, we got a new episode every 2 days, and no.
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a Gru. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a Gru. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
We are once again doing a special episode, not really about a traditional Infocom game. Although this one's by Infocom,
yes.
So our special episode is closer to an actual normal episode.
We are talking today about Fublitsky, which is an Infocom game, but not a text adventure. In 1985, 86, I think the market for text adventures was starting to go down a little bit. People were out there buying graphical games that, you know, and the graphics on computers were starting to get good.
Graphics are a fad.
I know. The best graphics are the ones in your mind.
Ooh, that sounds like a marketing slogan.
I think it was. But Infocom was trying to branch out and find something new, and so they came out with Fublitsky. It is essentially a board game. So we played it. It is a board game type game, sort of in the venue in the genre of Mastermind or Clue. You can play it on a computer. You need a computer to kind of be the board, be the arbitrator, and then you need 2 to 4 players, human players, to play the game.
Four people.
But we're only 2 people.
Where would we find 2 other people? Oh my goodness! Who are these other people in the room with us?
Me.
That was my segue.
Nice.
That little me was Quinn Dunkey, who has lowered her standards enough to come over to our podcast. Hello, Quinn.
Just when I thought my standards couldn't get any lower, you guys asked me to be on this thing. And I'm like, you know what? I've got a shovel. I can go lower.
you're here anyway.
Started digging.
She's at Kansas Fest. Corralled into the room. But anyway, so Quinn Dunkey from the Open Apple Podcast.
The Open Apple Podcast and Blondie Hacks and stuff like that.
And Fublitsky.
And Fublitsky now. Yes. 2-time loser of Rube.
Who would the world champion of Fublitsky be? Oh, I think it's me, listeners. So that's one person. Mm-hmm. Is there someone else in the room?
There is someone else in the room.
Yes, I'm Michael Sternberg.
Hello, Michael.
Hey.
This is our first time having guests on the show, and we got 2.
Yes.
2 guests.
Don't screw it up, you guys.
Yeah, the pressure is high.
Too late.
So we are all frequent Kansas Fest goers, and we are, just like the last episode, recording this live here at Kansas Fest. So you'll hear a bit of room tone and maybe some table banging, but we're going to do our best. We are excited to bring you the news from Fublitsky land. Well, I guess actually Fublitsky is the name of the town.
Yes.
So it's just the Fublitsky times as quickly as possible. So we knock out another episode because it was super fun to play this game.
Yeah.
So you're holding the box. We played on an actual vintage hardware, mm-hmm. using an actual disc. Did we use the disc or did you use the disc image?
Yeah, we used the disc.
Actual disc, yeah. On an actual Apple II. We rocked it old school.
Yeah.
Tried first on an Apple II, and it didn't work. You're waving at me. That makes for a great podcast. Tell me, Michael.
There's no gesturing in radio.
There's no gesturing. Just shout it out.
Well, the first time we were trying a 2E, and this game requires 128K RAM for an Apple.
But it said enhanced 2E.
Right.
But here at Kansas Fest, things get de-enhanced.
Right. This computer that I was trying to use, I got for free at the garage giveaway. And it was free on a table. It said boots. I didn't open it up. When I finally did, it was like super dusty. And, you know, who knows what happened to this poor machine in the last 30 years. It had been enhanced and then apparently de-enhanced.
It got de-enhanced.
So it just de-enhanced.
So that gave us...
Anyway, so we tried using this one machine and it didn't work. And so we've ended up finding another Apple.
Yeah,
so
we played on a 2C.
Well, 2C Plus, which,
ooh,
I think caused a little bit of issue the first time because we were playing it like 3 times faster than it would have normally.
I think that just made it nicer. Like,
better.
The animations were all super smooth.
Because we played it again, on using Virtual 2 on a Mac. Yeah. Played at regular 1 megahertz speed, yeah. And it was a little
choppier.
Little choppy, yeah. There was some chunky. Some what do you call it when graphics get all chopped up? Tearing. There was tearing in the graphics. I liked it at the faster speed better.
Yeah.
So I think this is a 2C game, 2C plus all the way.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's somehow interpreted, because they launched it on three titles or three platforms at the same time.
What platforms?
The IBM PC, which required 128K RAM mm-hmm. and a graphics card. And an Atari that only required 48K.
That's all you can do.
And really,
I mean, back in the day, it's all you could do on Atari.
Somehow it's able to.
Just back in the day.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, with modern upgrades and things, you can get all sorts of megabytes in there. But
sorts of megabytes. Yeah,
but that back then, that wasn't a thing.
We're lousy with megabytes.
And then the Apple computer,
yeah, the
which
Apple.
Required 128K.
Yep.
Yeah. Nice. So you're holding the box.
I'm holding the box.
Okay. Does it say something about it on the back of the box?
It does. It says Fublitsky, Infocom's graphic strategy game. Ages 14 to adult, number of players, 2 to 4. Approximate playing time, 1 to 2 hours.
How long did it take us, would you say? It was over an hour, wasn't it?
Yeah, like 2 hours the first time. I think we knocked that second game out. We didn't quite finish it in the time we had, but we were coming up on an hour.
Right. That's probably accurate. Yeah. Shorter than any other Infocom game we played.
Sure, absolutely. When you're normally looking at 20 hours or something.
But
and the 1 to 2 hours doesn't include getting the computer to work.
Yes. Yeah,
there was a lot of that at the beginning. Yeah.
And I mean, we should say it's a bit long on a casual family game kind of genre.
Yeah, to get people to commit to 2 hours.
Yeah, you want to aim for 30, 45 minutes.
Getting up in advanced Monopoly time.
Yeah, there were some house rules available to shorten the game.
You could see. Well, we'll talk about the gameplay, but there were some ways to
But
to
we
make
were
it
trying
harder.
To do it the regular
We play regular full Blitzky.
So, full Blitzky. Contents. Your computer disk, 4 colorful workboards, 4 equally colorful markers, and 2 sets of rules, the bare essentials, which will get you started, and official ordinances, which will provide you with more detailed information. The rules include variations for experts and suggestions for shorter play. Description: Fublitsky is a unique game of deduction, strategy, and chance. It's a dog-eat-dog world as you rove the crowded streets and busy shops of Fublitsky. What do you say? I don't like it, but I respect it.
Yes.
It does say, as you rove the crowded streets and busy shops of Fublitsky, trying to deduce and obtain the 4 objects needed to win the game. But this is no scavenger hunt, like many of our other games.
This is no StarCross.
Like Zork and StarCross. Victory depends on how well you use funds, keep records, and outsmart your fellow players. You'll test your skills, match wits with your opponents, and thrill yourself at the mercy of chance each time you play Fublitsky. The challenge will keep you coming back again and again and again. You can play Fublitsky with either a joystick or a keyboard. You'll need to use a monochrome or composite color monitor, not an RGB monitor. And the back
or a projector, like we did.
Right, and the back of the box has a nice color picture of the contents of the box and a little animation on a TV.
See, that blurb makes this game sound remarkably boring. Because you're nothing really what it's about. That doesn't entice me to play the game. Like you read that and go like, okay, yeah, you can. It's telling you more about what it is. You're going to get pieces of things and you're going to play a game. But it doesn't get you excited. That's a terrible way to describe a game. Somebody walking in a shop and holding that box.
Right.
What's going to make them pick that up over something else?
I get the feeling that the marketing company that did a lot of Infocom stuff and made them interesting... Didn't do this.
Yeah. I mean, I like these little workboards you said, like we're holding those.
Yeah.
And also, speaking of which, though, first, the instructions. Like you said, it comes with a small set of instructions and a big set of instructions.
Yes.
And I read through the instructions before playing, and it made me think, I'm going to hate this game.
The big set of instructions is about 28 pages.
And it seemed really complicated with a ton of mechanics that I thought I'm not going to keep straight of when you can cross roads and when you can't. You got to memorize stuff. It's kind of like Clue. It's kind of like Mastermind. You got to keep track of money and you can make it in a restaurant. It just seemed like a very complicated game, mm-hmm. which is odd for a 1980s game. It's not like some modern German thing.
Right.
So I thought, this is going to be terrible. Like the box is kind of pretty, and the stuff in the box looks nice, but the instructions sounded boring. The back of the box didn't sound enticing.
Right.
I thought we were in for Dullsville and Dulltown. which is like a very popular.
Yeah,
phrase.
I was
trips off the tongue.
Yeah, I was trying to set up the computer and get the podcasting or the video ready yesterday, and you were reading the instructions to me, and I'm just like, just lost.
And we had just done Starcross.
Yeah,
we'd already just like rage attacked one Infocom game here at Kansas Fest.
Right.
Thought, oh, here we go again. But happily, I love this thing. This was a very happy surprise. Mm-hmm. So the actual playing, very different than it sounded from the instructions of the box.
Right. We played the one game all together, which we'll talk about in a minute, which we did, and it started off kind of cumbersome because we're still learning the rules. And then by the second half of the game, we were into it. We pretty much figured stuff out, I think, and we were having a good time. And then as soon as we were done, I was just like, I want to play this again.
That's a sign of a good game.
Yeah,
you can actually sit down, play the thing for the first time, a little complicated, invest over an hour in it, and go right away, I'll totally do this again. Yeah. I would absolutely enjoy doing this
again.
And
we played a second game today. The first game we videotaped. If you want to watch it, we videotaped. We digitally recorded. I used a 3/4-inch beta.
Okay, Grandpa.
Yeah.
Monks carved it into rocks. You can see it like a
storage. We taped the full gameplay of the first game that we did yesterday, including our learning curve and a little unboxing that Carrington did. And the thing's like an hour and 20 minutes, and I don't recommend watching it. It's super long, but it's on YouTube if you really want to watch us play a board game.
More as really a record.
Especially if you're a Fublitsky fan and love Fublitsky in the 80s,
right.
You will be screaming at us
as we try to figure out what we're doing.
Yes.
Yeah, I did get the sense that anybody who really knows the game would be, you know, 25 minutes in and be screaming as they know the solution while we're still trying to figure out how to solve this thing. So we did bumble through a little bit, but I still dug it. So we hold in our hands at the moment colorful, what do you call them, work boards.
Yes.
So Quinn, you're holding a work board.
What are they called?
Extremely
colorful work boards.
Why don't you tell us what you've got in your hands?
So, sounds like that. It's like a bifold plastic-coated cardboard. So it's suitable for writing on with dry erase markers. It comes with color-matched dry erase markers. And on the top, there's a map, a duplicate of the map in the game, and with the locations of all the stores. It's, you know, it's a town. There's a subway. There's subways and there's stores and all these things you can move around. There's like an inventory section where you try to keep a log of what all the other players are holding. You're trying to guess what everybody's holding all the time. And then there's like an inventory section for the town where you keep track of which neighborhoods have which items in stock. Every neighborhood has one instance of each store type. So it's a deduction game in that you're trying to figure out what items everyone else is holding, and you do that by keeping track of what's in stock in all the stores because each neighborhood has exactly one of each item. So you can kind of deduce with that sort of information. So it's a lot of record keeping, and things are happening quickly in the game, so you're trying to figure out what you're trying to watch other players' turns all the time and write down what they're doing and figure out how it interacts with what you already know and all that sort of thing. So it's classic Infocom. The production values are great. These things are really nicely made. The dry erase markers were dried out after 30 years, so we had to get our own, but they still worked great on these board things. I thought they added a lot to the experience.
Yep, I agree.
And cleverly, when you have the map open, it acts as a screen so that people can't see
your... Right, you
flip it open. Oh, yes. Good point. Yeah, that is a thing that is built into the fact that it's bifold. Yeah.
It's very much a hidden information game. Like, it's all about you know things that no one else does, and you hope that they don't know what you know and all of that.
Oh, but at the same time, one of the differences between this and if it was, say, just a standard board game is... You're forced to share information because a lot of stuff, when you're told things, they're told on screen and everybody else gets to see it. So it's a matter of trying to maybe bluff people, get things that you don't want to fool people into thinking that you do want them, and you'll move really quickly when people are looking
at times where I think this would be a good strategy, but I mean, you would just do something quickly, and I would have blinked and missed it, and it was like, what were the three items that were on the screen? And,
who knows?
Yeah, then,
too bad.
So that, yeah.
In fact, in the first game, I blinked on my own initial move.
Right, so you didn't know what the one piece that you would know and no one else does, also you didn't know.
That's correct.
A distinct disadvantage.
So, I mean, basically, if it boil it down, it's like you're playing Mastermind, but all four people are trying to just deduce the same clue at the same time.
Right, and instead of little colored dots, you're trying to guess items from stores.
Items from stores,
yes. What kind of items are there?
There's a drugstore that has three items: hairspray, toothpaste, and an eyedropper. There's a grocery store that has three items: a banana, sardines, and a hot dog. There's a pet store that has fish, a snake, or a pig. And each of these items has a different price. It's either $4, $8, or $12.
What are 16.
Fubles.
Sorry, 4, 8, or 16.
Fubles.
And so
play on rubles, I assume.
Oh. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe that never occurred to me until now. Wow. I can't believe I'm the world champion of this game.
So there's so much information, you know, that comes in, and then you know from the beginning the cost of the four correct items, and that's like another bit of information, like, you know, like one of the items is 4 fubles and one is 16 or whatever.
Yeah, there's so many different ways that contribute to you guessing what things are.
And yet I consistently was guessing wrong about it.
But there's also so many times where you think, I think that leads to this, and you can easily make a logic error and you think a thing is one of the four. You're looking for four items. We each know from the beginning one of them. You're trying to deduce the other three.
Yeah.
So the combination of what the scores cost or what's missing from a store or what another character has. So there's ways on screen to check if you have what you have is correct. And it'll say, well, you currently have 3 items. 2 of the 3 are correct. It doesn't tell you which ones, but then you can look at that. That's a bit more information. There's the chance man. When you stop moving on a sidewalk, a guy might show up who basically flashes you. Even on the graphics here, Michael just pointed out, there's a flasher on the front of this. Yeah. So the chance man will come and open up his raincoat and flash you, and he may offer to sell you stuff. He may take something from you. He may drop a piano on you and then send you to the hospital. You can also get run over by cars and this gets sent to the hospital. But if the chance man offers you stuff, 1 of the 3 things he offers you will be one of the items you need. So it tells you 2 of those 3 are wrong, and all those little bits of info you have to sort of collect and gather till you can think of what are the 4 magic items in a sense. Gather those on your person and go to the checkpoint and see if you're correct, and that's how you win.
Yes.
And there's a risk-reward mechanic hidden in there as well, because often through deduction you can narrow it down to 2 or 3 items that is the final one you don't know, and so you might take a chance and go to the checkpoint with 1 of the 3, the 3 that you know for sure and the 1 that you are a little iffy on, and you might win early because you didn't wait until you were certain on all 4, but then if you guess wrong, everybody sees it and everybody gains a lot of information from that.
Right, so a lot of times the thing that gives you a lot of information also gives other people a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've buried the lead on the most important thing about this game, in which all the characters are dogs, and they're adorable.
The graphics are great. For an Infocom game known for having no graphics, they knocked it out of the park. I love the graphics of these. They're adorable. They're appropriate. Mm-hmm. They're great little animations. They're well done. Like, it's well, brilliantly executed, I think.
This visually is one of the best games. It's got to be one of the best games of that year. The graphics are incredibly charming and funny. The production values are great. Everything's elaborately animated. You know, no color fringe. Just they really nailed how to use the graphics on
the Apple II. Smart graphics for the Apple II, where they outline the whites and blacks so you don't get the weird fringing. It's a remarkably polished looking game for essentially a first graphics game from this company.
Yeah.
There was a weird person you looked at. Who were the graphics people that did this?
So it's Brian Cody, who was he attended the Massachusetts College of Art. And Paula Maxwell, they're credited as the artists.
Okay.
I checked Moby Games, and I didn't know that Paula Maxwell was, at the time, only had Brian Cody's name, and he had no other credits, so this would be his only credit.
Wow. Well done, dude.
Yeah.
Or maybe she did all the work.
Yeah.
This is only taking credit.
Yes.
There was also a fellow who did the coding.
Poe C. Lim. He's Malaysian, and he went to MIT in 76.
And they called him Magic Lim, right? Or Magical Lim?
In New York Times, they called him the programming magician.
Right.
Yeah, and the story was that he would put in his code these numbers, like, do not change this number.
I just love the magic number.
Do not change it.
So that was his code style.
And this is his only game credit as well for programming.
So this is for a bunch of people who are essentially, I guess, new to Infocom and doing their first game. Mm-hmm. It's adorable and it's super polished. I was very surprised at how much I like this game.
Yeah.
And I guess the name that you would recognize from other Infocom games is Michael Berlin, who did Suspended and Infidel and Cutthroats.
None of which we have done yet.
And he's more of a writer, right? So he had written science fiction novels, Integrated Man and Crystal Phoenix.
Right.
Before.
So we probably maybe help with the writing on this. There's not a lot of writing in this. In fact, Quinn and I were talking earlier how the game is well done for, what do you call it when you do it for another language?
Localization.
Localization is the word for that.
Yeah, they went for it with iconography rather than a lot of...
There's very little text on screen, most of which is just a counting clock, which would be universal. And instead of, like, do you buy something or do you take something, it'll be two little symbols of a store with one arrow going in, one arrow going out. Do you cross the street or you don't? There's a sitting dog or a walking dog, and you simply choose between two choices. And it's just adorable and well-done graphics that just, you know, immediately convey an idea in any language. So smart choice for... if they intended to sell a whole bunch of these, which apparently they did not.
Right, yeah. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but they sold like a total of 8,300 copies of this. Initially, it was sold only... in 1985, it was sold only to the readers of the Infocom newsletter, the New York Times, and... So you could order it for, I think you said it was $30?
Michael will tell us. So it was weirdly got cheap fast.
Yeah, and then in the next year, they made it generally available in software stores and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was announced in the volume 4, number 2 issue of New York Times. That was summer 85. And at that point, they said it would be available only to subscribers of the newsletter. And it only gave a general description. I didn't see anything about ordering information, so I don't know how that would be done. And then in the following month's newsletter, or the next newsletter, which was fall of 85, they described an intra-corporate tournament. So it was like the marketing department versus the programming department.
Oh, cool.
And there's some funny stories in that one. That's volume 4, number 3 of New York Times. And then finally, the third time it's mentioned, it says it's for $39.95 and still available only via New York Times. And that's in the winter of 86.
So even to stop for a second there. So that's $40, which is not a ton of money. But this is a large box with an injection molded plastic thing, four very large laminated fold-out cover things, four different colored markers, a disc, and all the software there. Like, this is a lot of packaging for a $40 game. And the price just drops from there quickly. So, okay, what happens next?
All right, so next is spring of 86. They announced that the game is now available at stores. And this is because there's a huge market that they're neglecting. It's the people who are afraid of the Postal Service. They call it postophobia. And then by the summer of 87, they announced that it would be reduced to $14.95 as part of a Classics edition.
Right, so that means this is a game that is not selling, and they're moving inventory. The price goes down from there.
Yeah, winter, spring of 88, it's available for $9.95.
Wow, that's shocking.
That's direct mail.
But within a year, this thing drops from $40 to $15.
Wow.
That is just, they've got inventory, it hasn't sold, let's just move it for below cost. Because there's no way they were producing this thing for $15.
No. Yeah. And I get that they were trying to... Maybe they saw that Text Adventures was a dying breed and they needed to move something else, and they picked something else, and you know, they chose poorly. And I don't know.
I feel bad about it though, because it's, in playing it, I learned it's a really fun game that I would recommend.
Yeah.
But in reading about it, it's a game that I thought would look boring and I wouldn't have played it if we weren't doing it for this show.
Apparently.
So, and I think it's the exact same thing. Yeah. So it's a marketing issue and not either designing a game that you can't describe to people easy enough to actually be able to sell, or maybe the marketing terms or something. But the difficulty here wasn't in really making a fun game, but making a fun game that could be described and pitched, or coming up with the right pitch. There's a fall down there somewhere.
It would be such a curveball to the Infocom fan at the time. Mm.
Right, maybe it should have been under a different name. Right. Maybe it shouldn't have been Infocom.
They were selling to their audience was not primed for this sort of thing.
Maybe it should have been like Gameocon, an Infocom company or something.
Right.
And go, because their built-in audience was... But then again, you're a company not going for your built-in... inbuilt audience. So, I don't know. But it's too bad it did that poorly, because I think it's actually really fun. I super enjoy playing this game.
Yeah, this has to be one of the most underappreciated Infocom games. I mean, I had heard of it as this weird other thing they did once, but knew nothing about it. And yeah, like I said, reading that copy, it sounds dry and boring. Although it is a lot funnier if once you understand the players are all dogs. Yes. That copy gets a lot more clever. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And we should mention the controls are also similar to the iconography. The controls are very clever. It's designed so you can play it entirely with a single joystick that you pass around, which makes sense because the setup for this is a little weird, right? You've got four people sitting around a table with an Apple II somehow sitting at the end so that everybody can see the screen. Right. Very awkward, honestly, mm-hmm. to set it up. But then you can pass the joystick around, so it works out.
You had somebody on Open Apple once who talked about the moving of the computer and how it disrupted like furnishings in the house. Mm-hmm. Who was that?
I forget her name.
So follow her on Twitter now. I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, I forget her name, but yeah, she studied how home computers affected domestic life and how furniture had to be invented for these things and homes had to change to figure out what room the computer belonged in and all that.
So this straddles that kind of strange era because computers come into the house and it's like, where are they going to go? Are they a thing that's in the living room? Are they a thing that's in a den? Does it go down in the basement or what have you?
Looney.
Loogie?
What's your name, Looney?
Lane Nooney.
Lane Nooney.
Thank you.
Nicely done, Michael.
Excellent.
So but that's the kind of thing where I wonder if this game is in an era where things are in flux. Because if the idea is a computer is a family item in a family room attached to the main TV, then this kind of makes more sense. But if that's like when they start coming up with this idea, and that's like 83, and by 85, well, no, computers are in a den or a work thing or whatever. Yeah. They're outside. They're not in the kitchen. They're elsewhere. Yeah. Then this now falls down because this game mechanic kind of requires you're sitting in front of a large television, comfortably back, moving the joystick. Yeah. It's a sit-back game. It is not gather around a desk. How would you all fit? So that's the thing. And we played it twice, the first time with a joystick on the real hardware, the second time just using the keyboard on an emulator. It is far better with the joystick. The joystick, I think, makes a massive difference. Keyboard's a little janky. It works fine, yeah. But it's much more fun to just sort of sit back and just move your little character with a joystick. So I think it's a game that benefited greatly from the use of the joystick.
Well, the joystick controls were very clever. I mean, it used what we would now in modern user experience design would call a pie menu. Everything was done with holding in a direction to choose from cardinal directions, which worked really, really well. Very elegant, very simple, and worked really well with their iconography.
Yeah.
And the joystick works for passing it down the line instead of huddling around the keyboard like cavemen.
Good point. With the joystick cable extends the range where people can sit around it because being spread out. And also being spread out helps hide the notes you're taking, which is a part of the game. So.
And it's worth noting, you never touch the keyboard. Even you put in the floppy disk, you turn on the machine, and immediately you're in the game. You've never touched the keyboard.
Oh, good point, yeah.
Like, we chose the number of players with the joystick. We, you know, did the initial setup with the joystick. We never touched the keyboard. So that was
another thing, because there's not only are you not reading a lot of stuff on screen, you're also not typing anything on screen. So also part of that localization, the new word I learned during this podcast.
But that could have been one of the barriers to entry. I mean, you're at this point, 85, your computer is sitting in a den or in an office or in someone's bedroom, you know, and you paid $3,000 for this thing and it weighs 40 pounds. You don't want to pick it up and move it into the dining room or the kitchen or wherever your gaming table is and set this thing up, you know, and get your friends over. And it's the barrier to entry is pretty high.
I also think of it as in a television Atari thing. As a kid, we had an Intellivision. And I really wanted an Atari 2600 at the same time. And I remember my dad saying, but you've got the television, which told me was better and had better graphics. But all the games are two-player games, and my sister doesn't want to play with me. So I've got all these games, and I can't play any of them by myself. I can't play Sea Battle. I can't, they're not powerful enough to have a computer AI. Yeah. And this is a game that is 2 to 4 people. There is no one player. So you buy Fubitsky, and you better have somebody else who wants to come over and spend 2 hours playing this board game with you. So
it's like committing to a game of Monopoly.
And every other Infocom game is like the definitive solo game. It's you and text and first person and spend tons of time and dribs and drabs if you want.
Right. Infocom was a company for lonely people. Yes. And this is a game for people with friends.
And we had to come to Kansas to find people who would play. So, but I mean, that's a very different market. Like, this is now you're going to spend your 40 or 15 or 10 or presumably soon $2. But you can't play it solo. So it sits on the shelf. And even if you play once, I liked it. And then, you know, Jane goes away and you're like, but I Jane's not here. I can't play anymore. Right. And you just have a game you can't play. So I think there was a lot of hurdles in the way of it. So I can see why it wasn't successful. I still feel bad about it, though, because it's the underdog. Oh, my dog. And I think it's much better than it deserved much better than a god, I think.
I mean, I think the design was a bit of its own enemy as well. That was another barrier to entry. I mean, a really good game, especially in the casual family space. Like, this game is clearly aimed at the family kind of board game, you know, family game night, whatever type of thing. The learning curve is steep. I mean, there's a lot of intricacies, and they just drop them on you. Like, you have to understand 80% of the game to play it at all. Not compared to, like, you know, Betrayal at House on the Hill that we played that same evening, where the learning curve is very gentle, and, you know, you only have to know one thing to start playing, and then within the first 5 minutes you've learned a second thing, and, you know, it very gently eases you into the game. This thing is just dropped on you like a brick.
With a whole bunch of mechanics and a whole bunch of reading that I can imagine would shut somebody down. You tell them all the instructions, this is complicated, I'm not having fun, and they're not open to it anymore.
Yeah.
We played because we basically had to, and ended up loving it. But I can see people just saying, "Oh, this is stupid. I don't want to play this thing."
Yeah, yeah. And really. At least two of us are hardcore board gamers, right?
Yeah.
So if any one could grok it, it should be us.
Yeah.
There were the first game is going to be a throwaway. It's just you're going to be
sure.
First game counts, and the winner of that is an important person.
Citation needed. Yeah, definitely one of those games where you play it once and throw it away because now you've made all the mistakes, and then the second game will be fun. Yeah.
I agree.
You mentioned Atari before your charge.
I'm sorry. I'll cut that part out.
We played the Apple II version, but as we said, this also came out for the Atari 800 and the IBM. I haven't looked at the IBM version. I'm sure it's terrible because it had to be. But I brought up a YouTube video of the Atari 8-bit version, and it looks very similar.
That's the Atari version?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was the Apple II.
Apple II version, too.
I think there's a couple of colors. I mean, the yellow, I don't remember the yellow. The
colors are a little better.
A little different.
Yeah. Oh, that dog in the video just got run over by a car. So are you playing that game? No one gets run over in this game like Kevin.
We called it getting Kevin.
So, anyway, the graphics are very similar.
I would have thought that video is of the Apple II version.
Yeah, they clearly ripped those sprites and put them in the Atari.
So that's the thing. So you would know this. So we're here with Michael, and one of the things Michael knows how to do is rip the guts out of an Infocom game and see what makes it. So
I took a peek.
Right.
I mean, I had a feeling that the Infocom programmers knew the Zork implementation language and their DEC PDP 11 system, that they would use that as their platform again to do any programming. So Wikipedia mentions that it's programmed in their Zork implementation language or their Z Machine language. But when I looked at the boot section, the first three tracks where I would expect the interpreter to be, I found the header of the code portion. It wasn't quite the same as the text adventure. So there's this there's a Z code header, and it says stuff like the serial number I saw it was 85 compile date 8512 something December, but it was completely a different beast, obviously. I mean, it's not going to be a text adventure, so they would have had to come up with a whole new graphic interpreter, but they would have programmed it using the language and tools that they knew already.
I would assume so as well, though I can imagine, like, or it's hard to imagine a worse platform than a DEC if you want to do a graphics game. Like, it's essentially a non-graphics computer.
Yeah.
Some stuff got added later, and I guess if this was done late enough, maybe then. I'm not really a DEC guy, but I think of that as a completely non-graphic computer. Like, a great one to do text adventures, but a terrible one to do development of a graphical game. So, I don't know. Maybe they're just... It's weird. I think it must be that. Maybe that's also why it was all new people.
There existed graphics terminals. I used to do CAD work, and we used these expensive graphics terminals that were connected to a VAX. So probably a few years later, but...
Big investment if it's just one game.
Yeah.
The digital antiquarian, Jimmy Marr, did a great article on Publitsky, as he does. And he mentions that... So this was their second attempt to add graphics to the Z Machine. The first attempt had been aborted. The second time around, they took what they learned and they thought, okay, we can't do arcade games, obviously. So what's something simple with big, you know, slow-moving graphics that we can do with this interpreted language and our deck-based build pipeline? And so someone said, a board game.
Aha. So, okay, then that explains it. Cool.
Do you think that this could have been a board game? not computer facilitated?
Yeah, that's a really good question. While we were playing, I was trying to study the mechanics and decide, like, was this a good use of the computer? Like, was this something, was this an experience you could only have with a computer in the loop? And I think we kind of decided probably not. Like, you could do this without the computer. All the random elements could be done with dice. All of the hidden information thing could be done with face-down cards. All the state-based stuff could be done with decks and cards. You'd need a lot of it, though. So I think that the computer definitely saves a lot of paperwork.
Mm-hmm. Would you not need a referee or someone to validate if someone has the four right choices?
I think there's some versions of Clue and stuff where you just put them on a secret envelope.
So Clue, their games have that mechanic. Like, all the mechanics in it are stock board game mechanics. So yes, the secret item combination thing is done by drawing cards without looking at them and putting them in an envelope, and you know,
Clue style. Basically.
You'd have to modify the rules a little bit. Like, the mastermind mechanic would not be possible, because once you've seen them, then you know the answer. But you know you were wrong, but now you also know what the right thing is, compared to like where mastermind, where there's two different people. But so I guess that is a good example of where the computer was helpful.
And the computer is keeping track of how many foobles you have, and you can't make illegal moves. Like if you spin a 20, you can only move 20.
Right.
I was hampered by that.
But any board game.
Lack of cheating.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
People monitor themselves and each other. And,
yeah. But I think most of it could be. Like, I can imagine this being tweaked and being just a board game.
Yeah, but it would be one of those board games that has 1,000 pieces and
maybe a lot of
spinners and dice and cards. And
yeah. But a lot of
not the kind of game I would play, because I'd get...
But then again, this was not the kind of game most people would play. No one played it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe it was just doomed from the outset. Maybe this was a bunch of board game-loving people, hardcore gamers that make games, who love games. So they're game fanatics. They decided, let's make a game.
Yeah.
And so their first game is a very complicated one with a ton of mechanics. It is actually really fun. They probably playtest the heck out of it and found a game that was actually fun to play. So that's what they put out into the world. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily a game that is okay to market or to get mass adoption, which is what you want as a publishing company.
So I listened to Jason Scott's interview, or watched Jason Scott's interview with Amy Briggs, who did Plundered Hearts, and she talked about the culture of Infocom when she was there, which is later years, but that they were basically all young and had no lives outside of work, and that they would, you know, at the end of the workday, they would just continue to hang out, and they would play games of Uno, they'd play games of Diplomacy, and there was a strong board and...
Like a gaming culture.
Game culture. They had softball tournaments outside of work.
Makes sense. Anyway, I dig it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say at the end of the day, it's a complicated game, but less so when you actually play it, and very fun.
Yeah, pleasantly surprised. And I think actually it's probably easier to play it now than it was then, because now we have good emulators on, on comfortably slender hardware that you could put on your table while you play.
Although, with a joystick, I would strongly recommend play it with a joystick.
Yeah, the keyboard controls are clunky.
I mean, if someone is listening to this and they're interested in playing the game, I think you can totally do it.
At Kansas Fest next year.
Yes, that it'll be here, I suppose. But you need, the game and an emulator or whatever. And the only other thing you need is the board where you take notes, which, frankly, right here, this is a nice laminated board that you're supposed to use a dry erase marker with, but you could do it with a PDF or a photocopied version. I'm sure there must be out there on the internets. And, you print out a couple, you could totally play this game today.
Yeah. The dry erase is nice, but you could just print it and use it as a one-time sheet. Just write on it with pen and then chuck it at the end of the game.
Yeah.
They're like, I like all this stuff, but this... It could be about that. All that said, I recommend the game. People should seek it out. You should find it. Grab a couple of friends and a joystick and play this game. I dug it.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Cool.
Me, not so much. I was clueless.
Did you not? No.
I enjoyed it. I was just, I was very baffled at the beginning. So, however baffled you were, I was two times baffled.
Two baffled?
That's my normal baffle coefficient. And anyway, so, but I did enjoy it. And,
would you recommend
it? I look forward to next year and a rematch.
See, I think that's the sign of a good game. We want to play it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that first playthrough was also muddled by, it was late, we were tired, and the hardware was fighting us every inch. We couldn't get the floppy drive to work, slots didn't work, we went through two different floppy emulators. So take all of that away, and I think it would have been a much more pleasant first experience.
Yep. Sure. Yeah. I dig it.
Me too. Before we sign off, I want to talk about, change the subject, talk about one other thing. I want to talk about You Are a Gru.
Which, good idea.
Yes. Just a real quickie thing. The gentleman who created it was Charles Mangan. Charles Mangan made a, for his Hackfest entry here at Kansas Fest, he used Inform to create a little game, a little text adventure game called You Are a Gru, and I love the conceit of it so much, in which you are a Gru.
Yeah.
and you are in the dark, and your goal, of course, is to find an adventurer and eat him.
And it has one of the best first lines in a text adventure is, "It is pitch dark. You are a Gru." It's not you are likely. I'm just. It's so perfect, and it just tells you exactly what this game is about. It sets the style. It's well written. I was able to complete it successfully with a score of 1 out of a possible 1, and I like that about the game too. Your score is 0 until your score is 1, and then you have 1. It's a simple goal for a simple Gru. I loved it.
When you move, is it you just move in the dark like you?
You are. It is pitch dark.
It says you bump into a wall.
That's one of the nice things. No, you. There's almost no movement in it per se, and you can't see anything. It's pitch dark. You have to use your other senses. As a Gru, you rely on smell and touch and hearing and taste. Taste the floor. You can tell boots have walked nearby. That sort of thing. The sight is taken out of the game. It's a complete role reversal. Not just in the fact that you're playing the Gru instead of the adventurer. It's like you're not going to see things. You're not going to gather treasure. You're not going to use torches. You're just going to try to, in the pitch darkness, eat the adventurer. That is the goal. Eat the adventurer. It's delightful.
It's very small. The writing is very sharp. The death, when you die, the last thing it says is, "It is pitch dark. You are an ex-Gru." And all the writing in between is clever and funny and snappy.
Well worth a shout out.
Yeah, and he was one of the Hackfest winners.
And
right?
He won second place at the Hackfest for Kansas Fest 2017. I was the chief judge this year, and we had a great field. A lot of strong competition. He was up against 9 great entries, and second place, well deserved.
Yep. Yeah. Terrific game. Well worth the shout out. Yeah.
I'll have to ask him what it's like to be clever.
Less befuddled. So it was. I dug it.
Me too.
So cool. So that's it.
I think that's it.
No spoiler fence.
No spoiler fence.
Wow, my goodness. This is a crazy, crazy episode.
I know, it's crazy.
We already know what our... Oh, let's talk about... Where
talk
else,
about yourselves.
Yeah, you two. Where else can we find you?
Well, I'm on the Open Apple podcast. I also blog at quindunky.com/blondiehacks. You can find me on Twitter at quindunky. And I produce content all over the internet. And I'm easy to find.
And I'm an occasional retro challenge participant, and so I have a webpage called 16k.com where I post my retro challenge entries, and I have a Twitter account with that same name, 16kram.
Excellent.
And we other than that, you'll find me hiding somewhere.
In the dark.
Yes.
Licking the floor for adventurers. It's okay, so we will have links to both y'all. On the show notes, which you can find at monsterfeet.com/Gru. This has been Eaten by Gru, an occasional Infocom-ish podcast. Mm-hmm. Going back to Infocom. We know what our next... What's our next game?
Our next game is going to be Zork 2.
Zork 2, already announced in the pre-spoiler fence.
Which I learned in my research. I haven't started playing it yet, but I learned the official name is Zork 2, the Wizard of Froboz.
Okay.
That's the whole name.
Oh, I get pun on the Wizard of Oz. I get it. Cool.
Yeah, I get it.
So that's it. So thank you for listening. If you want to be our bestest buddies, you can leave a 5-star or another number, but 5 is the best number of stars, on, let's say, a review on iTunes. That's a good place for it.
Sure.
And other people can find the fun. We also want to thank MC Frontalot for giving us his sick rhymes to use as our theme song. That's awesome. Meanwhile, if you want to hit us up, you can send feedback at Gru, that's G-R-U-E at monsterfeet.com, or you can find Kevin and me on Twitter. He is at Kevin Savitz. I am at Carrington. And we will talk to you next time. Thanks for podcasting, guys.
Thank you.
Oh, no. You have walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking Gru.
I've played the game. That's what I've done.
I showed up and lost twice. That's what I brought.
I won twice.
Shut up.